This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We move people from being subsistence farmers to being farmers who are able to sell their crops and make a profit is that we do something called savings and credits, which has been around in Africa for a very long time.
That's Kate Schechter saying food security is the top priority for most poor communities. Details coming up. Also, Niger says it's revoking its military cooperation deal with the United States, and major disruptions to internet services across Africa have caused severe damage to economies. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Niger said it is revoking its military cooperation deal with the United States, ordering 1,000 American Armed Forces personnel to leave the country. We look at what is that supposed to mean for the U.S. as well as Niger. Jeff Selden, VOA National Security Correspondent, is standing by to brief us on the matter. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Jeff.
Thank you for having me.
So, American officials say they have tried for months to prevent a formal break in relations with Niger's junta. But this announcement by the West African nation's military junta on Saturday came after meetings last week with a delegation from Washington and the top U.S. commander for Africa, General Michael E. Langley. What happened at that meeting?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? The meeting that took place last week in the capital included the commander of U.S. Africa Command. It included top State Department, top Pentagon officials. And what U.S. officials at the Pentagon are telling us is that that delegation from the U.S. made very clear that it had concerns, that while it wanted to continue to pursue a military agreement and cooperation with Niger, that there are concerns about the direction that Niger is going, about its commitment to democratic principles, and especially about its growing relationship with both Russia and Iran. Now, there are also reports that some of the most heated discussion came after the U.S. raised concerns about a deal that's been rumored between Iran and Niger, where Iran would gain access to some of Niger's uranium and nuclear material reserves, and that may have caused the break. But there's still a lot of confusion. And as of this morning at the Pentagon, officials are saying the U.S. has not been given any sort of timeline, any sort of date for when U.S. troops would have to leave the country.
As you well know, Jeff, most of the Americans posted to Niger are stationed at U.S. Air Base 201, a six-year-old $110 million installation in the country's desert north. But since the military coup that ousted President Mohamed Bazoum last July, the troops there have been inactive, with most of their drones grounded. Have U.S. officials indicated what will happen to the base and when the troops will leave Niger?
Well, again, as of right now, there is no timeline that the U.S. is able to provide, and they cite the fact that they've been given no deadlines by the military junta in Niger for when troops are supposed to leave. There's also some confusion about whether this is just the military junta or the entire Nigerian interim government that wants the U.S. out. But the key point for the U.S. and what has been worrisome for officials is that essentially since the coup last July, all counterterrorism operations out of that critical U.S. airbase, Airbase 201, they've been grounded. The U.S. Forces there, there are about 1,000 U.S. forces, troops, and civilian personnel still in the country, mostly at that airbase, have been doing some what they call ISR, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance missions with drones, but it's been focused only on force protection, and they've not been able to focus, as their original mission was, on concerning developments and growth by terrorist organizations, including the Islamic State and its affiliates there, and Al-Qaeda affiliates in Niger.
And lastly, Jeff, some analysts are saying cancellation of the U.S. agreement is not quite as firm a break as Niger's split with France has been. They indicate it might be more of a negotiation tactic. How are U.S. officials viewing the break?
U.S. officials obviously are concerned, and they repeat the lines, especially at the Pentagon, that the U.S. would prefer to continue its military cooperation with Niger to work together on counterterrorism, on containing the threat from al-Qaeda affiliates and from Islamic State affiliates in the region and across Africa. They see Niger, the base there, as a critical one because of the ability it gives them, it gives the U.S. forces, to reach, to keep eyes on these terrorist groups that are growing throughout the region and to be able to help militaries in the region counter them when called for, when the agreement's permitted and when joint operations are put into effect. That's not been happening, of course. And so the U.S. is concerned, but there also seems to be a lot of ambiguity about exactly what is going on. Again, U.S. officials are saying they've been given no deadline for when U.S. troops would need to leave the country. And there are multiple reports that this may be a request or a demand or a tactic by the ruling military junta, but that other officials in Niger have said that they want U.S. troops to stay. So what happens next is also unclear. And, of course, some of the biggest questions remain on what is happening at the same time with the relationship between the military junta and Russian forces and Iran. Remember that there's been some agreements by what was called the Wagner Group, which is now being called by a lot of people Africa Corps, that has people on the ground in Niger to work with them on counterterrorism. There's been increased talks between Niger and Iran, and both Iran and Russia would like to see the U.S. push further and further out. And earlier, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Democrat Jack Reed, told reporters that he sees the development in Niger as part of Russia's strategy to make things difficult for the U.S., to create problems for the U.S., and to hurt the U.S. ability to counterterrorism, to counter terrorist groups, because that weakens the U.S. and the West overall.
Jeff Selden, VOA's national security correspondent, thank you for your input.
Anytime. There.
There have been major disruptions to internet services across Africa, resulting in severe damage to economies in an era when many companies and individuals rely on connectivity to do business. Tech experts tell VOA the outage began last Thursday when undersea cables were damaged.
Countries affected so far by internet breakdowns include South Africa, Nigeria, Ivory Coast, Liberia, Benin, Ghana, and Burkina Faso. In some regions, the internet's been down for days. In others, the service is slow. The chief executive officer of Johannesburg tech firm Worldwide Works, Arthur Goldstuck, says about 99% of the world's internet traffic travels via undersea cables that run between continents.
The African continent obviously is heavily dependent on subsea cables for international access. A lot of companies that are located within the continent still also rely on people accessing them via those undersea cables, because the big servers, the big hubs of all the content where people essentially gather their content together and then distribute it is typically in North America or Western Europe. So when those cables go down, even local sites suffer.
Goldstuck tells VOA a multitude of cables now encircle Africa.
Since around 2009, one cable after the other has connected us. And you would think that we would then be safe from any outages. The problem is a lot of these cables run along the same routes on the seabed. And the seabed is like on land, there are mountain ranges at the bottom of the sea, and it seems like there was some kind of earthquake on the seabed that in the same spot cut four cables at the same time, and suddenly our internet went down.
Jan Vermeulens, also a tech expert and editor of South Africa's My Broadband magazine, he thinks there was a different cause off the coast of Ivory Coast. Vermeulen says many fishing trawlers operate in the shallow waters there, and he suspects one of the vessels severed several fiber optic cables. He says the outages especially affect users of Microsoft, the world's leading computer software company.
It's not the first time Microsoft's had an outage, but it's certainly the first one that I can remember at this scale, impacting literally everything. for this amount of time, and that is going to require this amount of time to fix. It's a very long time for people to not be able to access their Microsoft-hosted emails, not to be able to access Teams, which many organizations in South Africa have come to rely on for remote working, for meetings and that sort of thing.
Vermeulen says the Microsoft outage is particularly damaging to Africa's larger economies.
South Africa is deeply entrenched in Microsoft's ecosystem. I always joke that we kind of planet Microsoft down here, and that dates back to the 1980s. I grew up on MS-DOS. Corporate South Africa adopted DOS and later Windows, and the South African government is reliant on these applications. Most of corporate South Africa and most of government could not work.
The internet's back up and running in South Africa, but it's currently slower than it usually is. Microsoft said its network in Africa is steadily improving and should be normal within days. The company said its teams are working actively to increase capacity in the region. Vermeulen says the lesson to be learned is that internet service providers should always have extra cables on standby, ready for activation should others be inoperable. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Men in army uniforms ransacked and burned homes in Nigeria's oil-producing Delta State days after youths killed 16 soldiers sent there to resolve a land dispute. The defense chief denies military involvement. Residents said soldiers attacked the Riverside Okuama community of a few hundred people yesterday while looking for those responsible for Thursday's killings. One resident told Reuters that uniformed men looked for weapons and ransacked houses before torching them. Government-owned properties, including a primary school and hospital, were spared. Defense Chief General Christopher Musa denies soldiers attacked the community. He says there were no reprisals by the army, which is searching for the assailants and their weapons. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Ingeri Migwi is a domestic violence survivor. In 2019, she co-founded and became CEO of Usi Kimye, which means don't be silent in Swahili. The organization aims to help rescue and assist Kenya's silent victims of gender-based violence who feel helpless and trapped in violent relationships. In January alone, she tells me that 32 Kenyan women were victims of femicide, defined by the United Nations as the intentional killing with a gender-related motivation. Ingeri starts out by telling me her personal story, which unfolds with a decade of domestic abuse.
As a survivor of gender-based violence, whereby I got married, I had a teenage pregnancy, and after 15 years of being in a bad marriage, I finally managed to leave the marriage. Through the help of my father, I was able to leave and start over. I left with my two children, a boy and a girl, and I was able to rebuild my life. To give survivors voice and agency, to be able to, for them to leave bad marriages. I was able to now, myself and my co-founder, Stella Kachina, we were able to come together, open safe houses where there were not safe houses for women in Kenya. In fact, we are still struggling to get the government to recognize what a safe house is or a shelter for women. It is still not recognized in this country. As a matter of fact, I have been arrested, you know, having a shelter that is a safe haven for women and their children.
If we look at the latest news regarding gender-based violence in Kenya, about 60 women have been killed since the beginning of the year, yes, according to the government. Why are these attacks surging? And what, if any, is the government doing to end the abuse and even helping your organization?
First and foremost, let me say this. The government has not said anything. It is us who are trying to push the government to enact and to pass laws around femicide. Unfortunately, right now, we are looking at an environment that is full of toxic masculinity. And as usual, women are the ones who get the brunt of the violence that we suffer. Also, femicide is coming through. It's the culmination, it's a manifestation of unchecked gender-based violence that has been ongoing, and nothing has been done to prevent it for several years. And so as such, people have seen that the judicial resolve is very slow. The system is very sluggish. And as such, people do not believe that the system works in things like gender-based violence. So apathy, you know, all these things that are giving an enabling environment where women can be killed. And then there is a lot of victim blaming and justification as to why this happened.
Njeri, your message to the victims and survivors of gender-based violence.
For me, what I will tell survivors of gender-based violence today is that there is help. You do not have to suffer in silence, and you do not have to suffer alone. Right now, there are methods in which in Kenya you are able to seek for help and actually get it. So we are here to tell any survivor who's hearing this that there is help out there. Look for us, Usikimia, on all our social media.
And lastly, Njeri, talk to us about what your organization is doing, in dealing with femicide, like providing medical evaluation and treatment emergency, contraceptives, trauma counseling. Talk to us a little about what you're doing.
If you're looking for help, if you have been raped, if you have gone through an intimate partner violence, we're able to connect you to the police so that your case is able to be recorded and you can start the journey towards justice. But more than that, we help with medical intervention. We also have an in-house psychologist. You are able to equip yourself with the necessary skills that are needed for psychological care. We are also able to give you protection in terms of giving you a safe space to stay as you make the arrangements within how you're going to now get back to society. So we're able to give you accommodation, clothing, and a place to stay for a limited period of time, of course, and limited spaces also are available.
You just mentioned mm-hmm. that the government is not helping. Where are you getting the funding to do all this?
Our funding comes from a lot of Kenyan well-wishers themselves, the Kenyan public, through our platform for raising funds. In Kenya, it's called Mchanga. So we're able to get funds from there. Other than that, we do not get any funding from the government. We are also funded by two independent philanthropists.
That was Njeri Megwe, a domestic violence survivor who co-founded and became CEO of Use Kimwe to help other victims. She was speaking with me from Nairobi. Spanish police have arrested three people for the deaths of five migrants who were forced off a speedboat last November just off a beach in southern Spain. Reuters says two men and one woman have been detained in the Algirecas area, about 70 kilometers southeast of Cadiz. They are accused of forcing the migrants to jump at knife point into strong currents. The Ministry of the Interior says the three are also suspected of belonging to a criminal organization, committing offenses against the rights of foreign nationals and causing injuries and smuggling. The European Union, which seeks to stem arrivals of illegal migrants and cash-strapped Egypt, have signed an $8 billion package of loans, grants, and energy cooperation deals. It includes billions in credit over the coming years and deals to step up imports of Egyptian energy to help Europe move further away from Russian gas amid the Ukrainian war, a senior European Commission official told the French news agency AFP. The agreement also includes about $5 million in loans over 4 years and $2 billion in investment and hundreds of millions for bilateral projects, including on migration, the official said, on condition of anonymity. Many factors, both internal and external, affect the rate at which countries develop and shape how it's translated into domestic and foreign policies. Kate Schechter, Chief Executive Officer of the charity World Neighbors, recently spoke with the Council on foreign relations about what she sees based on her organization's work in 14 countries in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Schechter tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that World Neighbors works exclusively in low-income communities that are the poorest of the poor, who often are battling conflict and climate change. She says in many African countries, the top priority is food security.
When we say that, we're talking about a whole myriad of different issues, how climate change affects their farming, how climate change affects their housing and their security. In West Africa, I would say a top of the issue right now for our communities is just plain old security. Security from Islamic Jihad groups that are attacking them, security from different factions fighting. We work in both Mali and Burkina Faso. And then for us, the way that we are kind of addressing that and the way that we feel we can really make a dent and a long-lasting dent in this issue of concern about food so that we move people from being subsistence farmers to being farmers who are able to sell their crops and make a profit is that we do something called savings and credits, which has been around in Africa for a very long time. In our case, we're primarily focused on women who don't have access to credit and to loans. We're, as I said before, we're working in very remote areas where many times there's no banking system. And so this is a system that is actually not just used, of course, by us, but by many international development groups where people form small groups and they save money together. And initially, I thought, you know, that sounds lovely, but how much money can people really save, you know, when they don't have any money and they have no income? But it's been really, really shocking to me how much money can be saved. And
so you mean they kind of like pool their resources together, the little bit that they are able to save and to reinvest then?
Exactly. So you kind of skip the whole banking level and you're having small groups of people get together. They each put in a small amount every week. It could be 50 cents. And then when it's accumulated to a point where they can start to loan it out, they loan it at very low interest rates. And this is much better than microfinancing, because the problem with microfinancing that all the international development field understood over time is you're still dependent on a bank. You still owe money to a bank. And if you default, you could be more destitute than you were before you took out the loan. So this is a community-based process in which if somebody can't pay back the loan, the community steps in to help them. And then we support them as they move forward with their businesses.
Your group focuses on long-term transformation rather than immediate crises. So what kinds of things do you do to help dig out of debt or to just, like you say, they pool their resources and then they get a small business off the ground? What's your role in that and how do you help them become self-reliant?
Well, initially, we are training people. All our staff are local and they speak the dialects of these villagers that are, you know, many times not close enough to a main city to speak French or English, not even Swahili in some cases. So our staff, which is very small, we have an office in Nairobi and an office in Ouagadougou, but they are able to travel to the other countries where we work. And they set up trainings. Many times it's with former farmers who worked with us, who have now what we call graduated and now have their own quite thriving businesses. And they come in and train. And then we have local, what we call social mobilizers, people who live in the villages who are also starting their own businesses, but are monitoring. They are kind of pushing the process forward.
That's Kate Schechter, CEO of World Neighbors. She was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam here in Washington. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiya Swuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer David Van Dee and our engineer Bill Androdi, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.